on page two, you were talking about your grandfather and your father, and about High Valley, and they had had butter, and you said they peddled it around the mines, up around Cornucopia, Cuprum, and Idaho. Now, can you tell me in what direction would Cornucopia and Cuprum be from Union, and about how far away?
Cornucopia is right at the upper end of Eagle Valley, Pine Valley, I mean. Over halfway. Cornucopia is about, imagine about 6-7 miles, imagine northwest of halfway.
So would it be northeast of Union?
Yeah.
And about how many miles?
Southeast.
Southeast.
Okay.
And about how many?
It's right behind China Cap over there.
Okay. I don't know where that is. About how many miles? 50? 100?
Well, there are miles, I would say probably 50 miles.
Okay. Good. That settles that. And when you started as a section hand, you were at Telecasset. I've been in Telecasset, but how far from Union is it?
Oh, 9 miles.
9 miles. Good. And how far is North Powder from Union?
16 miles.
This is page four. Page six. You said, my seniority date was established the 13th of March, 1937, and then they got another slump, and I was cut off. I was on the board. Later on, you explain what the board is, but would you explain it again for here?
The board is where they marked us all up, and all our names was on it, and they, in train service, we worked in what they call chain gang.
Yes. And would the board be in the clerk's office?
Yeah.
Okay. And was it chalk?
They had a chalk board, yes, that they put the crews on as they were called, but they also had a cabinet there with our names.
Okay.
And as we come in, they'd put our name at the bottom of this. It was called a board, and as we was called, we'd move up.
Uh-huh.
Until we was first out and then get called, and when they take us off the board and put us in, mark us up as a crew.
Well, were your names on little pieces of wood or paper?
Little tag.
Tags, and then they would literally move up in the row of, on the board?
Yeah.
Okay, were they fastened by hooks or
tacks? They had little hooks stuck up.
Okay.
I think I've got one up in another album there.
Oh, good. I'd like to see that. Then you said, I got up to take an out. What's an out?
I don't remember what we're talking about.
It was about the board.
Oh, I went to work. Went out.
Going out. Okay, on a train.
Yeah.
Okay. Then I worked at Pondosa. How far is that from Union?
Let's see, it's 21 miles.
Okay.
That's.
I thought you'd know all these distances.
Southeast. It's on that highway
from
Medical Spring.
Yes. All right. I've been by it. And then beginning long-term work on the railroad, I got assigned to Reef Pendleton. Now, explain to me about what Reef Pendleton means.
Reef Pendleton was a yard. And the main... See, Pendleton didn't have room enough for a yard and the switch crews. And the main switch engine and where the terminal for the freight crews from LeGrand was Reese, but it was a combination. They called it Reese Pendleton Yard because we worked out of Reese into the Pendleton. They had a yard there where they stored cars and for wheat and for the flouring mills and where coal come in, where they unloaded coal,
mm-hmm.
where they iced the reefers in those days for to load cherries and fruit and stuff in. And we'd take these reefer, that Smythe Bartell coal yard there right on Main Street. It'd be just east of the old depot, was where they used to ice the reefers, and then they'd send them over to Melton Free Water, and some of them would go down to Umatilla, down to Arrigan, and down in there.
Well, was Reef Pendleton just east of Pendleton?
No, it's west of Pendleton.
West, toward Hinkle.
Yeah.
About how far from Pendleton then?
2 miles.
2 miles. Okay. Is that still there? That's
well,
that same
part
yard?
Part of it is. Mm-hmm. Part of the yard was tore out. They tore the old roundhouse out and the old turntable. Mm-hmm. But I think there's either two or three tracks there. They call it Pendairs now.
Pendairs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's called Pendair. Well, there's Reese also, a passing track at Reese. Mm-hmm. But there, where the trains make their transfers, called Pendair. That's a bunch of tracks just west of the Umatilla River, right there by the old insane asylum.
I see. Is that spelled P-E-N-D-A-I-R?
What?
Pendair.
Yeah, P-E-N-D-A-I-R.
Okay. On page 7, I think I know what a fusee is, a red fusee, but will you explain it?
The red fusee is that we had on the railroad. They had a deal on the end that you could, on the cap was what they called an igniter, and it had a tape over this cap that kept it dry. Mm-hmm. When you lit the fusee like out in a storm, or when you was out going to stick it in the track, you tear this tape off the top of the cap, and then turn that cap and strike the end of the fusee, and that it was just like striking a match, and it ignited.
Truckers are still using something very similar, aren't they?
A lot of state police use them. You see them laying along on the highway at an accident and stuff.
I think I would have called them flares.
Well, they are called flares on the highway and stuff.
Yeah.
But the railroad, they're fusees.
Okay, got it. Also, page 7, he said, when I got back to the caboose, I hollered at the conductor, Denny Daugherty, and said, hey, Denny, come here. I want to show you something. Oh, what do you want? I said, get down here before I get my highball.
Well, that was, I stood behind the caboose. They're hearing the track. When you're going west, the train is headed east.
Yeah.
And there was a curve there where you come down off the grade toward Meacham. Well, when we come in, we could see the engineer if we stepped out from behind the caboose. So where I saw this cougar track, well, I stayed over behind the caboose so the head man couldn't see my lantern when we were swinging it around there looking at this cougar track.
Yeah.
And then as soon as Denny looked at it, I went out and gave him a proceed signal, what we call a proceed signal, or a highball.
Okay, so it's a hand signal.
Yeah.
Good. AJ, this might have been my mistake, but you were talking about we still had steam engines, and then you said, I think we got the steam diesels in 51 or 52. Is there such a thing as a steam diesel?
They combinated them.
Really?
They worked the steam engines in with the diesel engine, not in the unit itself, but like say there would be maybe two or three units of a diesel unit, and if they needed the additional power, sometimes they'd put a steam engine on the head end or a steam engine right behind, and of course there was an engine crew on the steam engine as well as on the diesel engine.
Okay. So it wasn't a diesel that was used to generate steam.
Well, now this, is that in referring to that 8444?
Not necessarily. This was in connection, I think, with the seeing the cougar.
Oh.
And John said, what year was this?
Well, that's
and you said probably 46, 47, when we still had steam engines.
Oh, yeah.
I think we got the steam diesels in 51 or 52.
Well, see, we had a combination there. I think it was 51 or 52, and they brought the first diesels. But they didn't have enough of them yet in order to handle all the power, and they used steam engines along with it.
Uh-huh. Would the diesel usually be between two steam engines?
Oh, not really. Most of the time it was either a steam engine coupled on the head end of a three or four diesels, or and then they used the steam engines more or less ahead of on the rear end of the train for helpers.
And of course you'd have to have an engineer in the steam.
Oh, yeah.
You couldn't operate them by the way they do now, by remote control.
No, they weren't interconnected.
Right, right. Okay, also page 8. About hand-firing steam engines.
I got my butt chewed out because I turned my rear end forward.
Yeah, you got that. That's right. It wasn't anything to go through 13 or 14 tons of coal from Union to Tallahassee. About how many miles would that be?
9 miles.
9 miles. We'd have to take the coal and everything on some of the engines up there. I wasn't sure what there meant. You think that would be
Tallahassee?
Yeah.
See, they had a coal chute at Tallahassee.
Yeah.
When I hired out on the section, we had to clean, when they take coal, there's always a certain amount of coal fall off the top of the tender.
Yeah.
And we had to make sure that was all cleaned out right after a train had been there so it wouldn't freeze in the ice and the snow.
Mm-hmm.
And, but they, practically every one of them that was a coal burner in those days would have to take coal there. They even had a coal chute at Baker at that time.
Uh-huh. And you said some of the engines had stokers and some didn't, but the stokers were good because the firemen could pile the coal up in the back of the firebox and then take a big long poke and break that pile down and push it to the round in the firebox.
Well,
tell me what a round is.
Push it around over the grate, cover the grate. See, as those stokers were set on the where the back of the boiler was like this. The main chute, there was an auger that came out of the tender that worked off the steam somehow. I don't know, because I wasn't a fireman, and I never learned it. But I did know that when these stokers were working, this auger was augering coal to it. Well, as it come up, later on, those 3900s and 4000s that they had out of Cheyenne, they had air vents on these stokers so they could open an air vent and blow the coal to various places if there was a hole in their fire. They had to keep those holes plugged up with the coal so they burned. Otherwise, they wouldn't generate enough steam.
Is it round, one of those holes?
Well, some of those holes were round. The firebox itself was a more or less oblong and square, but they had this big long handle poker, and it had a blade on it about that wide and about that long, and they'd go in through the door like that and give it a twist and flip that coal from where it piled up from the stoker to various places in the firebox.
That was to get it to burn better?
Yeah.
Okay. So would it be accurate to say that the round is simply a place in the firebox where you want the coal to be?
Right.
Okay. Page 9. As I remember, they had converted most of those old sleds, as they call them, to oil burners by the time I went to work. And when they converted them, they said they simpled the engine.
That is something I don't know enough about steam. The old compound engines, they had those great big cylinders. And see, the the hot steam, what they called hot steam, went to the back engine.
Yeah.
Well, as it exhausted, the exhaust would go to the front engine, and they needed the bigger cylinders to get the power efficiency out of the steam. Well, when they converted them to oil, they did away with that big cylinder on the head end, and they said that it templed them by putting hot steam to all four of the cylinders on those Malley engines.
Why would they use the term simple?
That is something I can't tell you, because I don't know enough. I wasn't in the engine service.
It sounds as though you were, though, from what you said.
Well, I wrote a lot of them, and I...
You sounded like an authority to me.
But the term that they simpled the engine by doing away with that, those big cylinders on the head end.
Okay.
And
so it made it a little less complicated?
Yeah.
Okay, that figures.
And give them more power.
Sure. Okay. Page 10. This is about the 9000. The center cylinder sat right up even with the front of the boiler out in front. It was a really rigid engine. They did run it in here a time or two, but it knocked all the curves out. It also knocked the gauges of track out.
Okay, the tracks are gauged. I can't tell you. I think it's 3 feet.
It's the width of the track. Two tracks from each other?
Yeah. And on these curves, anything over, I think it was an 8-degree curve, those engines were so rigid that when the wheels are going around, when the wheels hit the rail on the top side, why, it was forcing a pressure on there.
They bulged apart?
Yeah.
Okay. So they were... When they're out of gauge, that might cause an accident when the next train came by, right?
Right, or even your train itself.
Yeah. Rear cars.
Cars could derail.
Sure, sure. Okay, you said several things about the tunnel at Wetherby. Where is Wetherby?
Well, let's see. How far is it east of Durkee?
Where's Durkee?
Durkee's east of Baker, and it was the foot of the mountains over there, and Durkee was a helper station. And then Wetherby is the second passing track east of Durkee toward Huntington. And about a mile east of the passing track was a tunnel that goes through the mountain. You can see it if you're driving to
I've never been over there, but I know where it is. And about how long a tunnel was it?
Oh, I imagine that tunnel was probably a couple hundred yards.
And it had two tracks?
It's got a curve in it. I don't remember what the gauge was. I think it was 8-degree curve or curvature in there.
Did it have one or two tracks through it?
One.
Okay, page 12. Oh, well, this is the Wetherby Tunnel again, and you've already told me where it was. I haven't got that. Page 13. In those days, the crew consisted of a conductor and three brakemen, the head brakeman and the swing brakeman. Now, did you mean three brakemen, or did you mean two brakemen and one fireman?
No, he was a flagman.
The other one was a flagman.
Yeah.
Is the flagman also called a brakeman?
Yes.
Oh.
Huh. Yeah.
Why was that? I mean, what is the meaning of the term brakeman?
There was a full crew, a brakeman or trainman. In those days, in the early day of railroading, why the brakeman used to carry a brake club when they first got air, and they would go up, like coming down the hill, and they'd set a certain amount of handbrakes on the cars to help the engineer as they begin to get better air equipment.
Yes.
Some of the first engines only had a single pump, what they call a single pump on there. One side worked the pump, and one side pumped the air. And in order to assist the engineer bringing down, why, we had a brake clip. They were about 3 feet long, and well, they were shaped similar to a baseball bat. And the end where we stuck it through the wheel to tighten up the brake was square, and then the handle come out on it. And we'd wrap those brakes up, and there's a ratchet up there on the staffs that held it. Well, then, to tighten it up a little tighter, we'd put that brake club on to give us more leverage to tighten it up.
But as they got better engines, then the brakemen didn't have to do that anymore, right?
No, we had to use what they call retaining valves.
So. But I'm getting the idea that eventually brakemen, or men who were called brakemen, didn't necessarily do anything with the brakes.
Well, not on the main line. Well, they did in a way. If you made a set out anywhere, none of this track is level. And if the train, if you were doing local work, if you got called for, you didn't know when you left here, you didn't know whether you'd get a hotshot train back in or another local. Well, if you got a local, there'd be a lot of handbrakes to set where you'd set cars out and brakes to let off when you picked it up.
Why was one brakeman called a swing brakeman?
Because he was filled in wherever necessary. He was the guy that did most of the work.
Okay.
The head brakeman, he put the engine on the train and checked the head end for brakes in the yard, and then the flagman would go over the train and let the handbrakes check the train for handbrake. The swing brakeman made a switch list, what we called a switch list of the train, so that he and the conductor could compare the way bills if there was cars to be set out en route. So he filled in wherever. He did a lot of the footwork for the conductor is what it actually was.
And then one of the brakemen, called a flagman, did what you were doing, just got out on the track and
when they had a rule,
protected the both ends of the train.
And then when you was out on the main line or out on the track, they had a rule in the rule book, said that any time that you stopped on the main line, except clear of a yard or a siding, the flagman must go back immediately with flagging equipment to protect the rear end of the train.
Yeah.
And that's what I was doing that night. That cougar followed me.
Yeah. In order to really protect the rear end of a train from a rear end crash, you'd have to go quite a ways, wouldn't you?
Well, the rule required that you go back a mile and a quarter.
Ah, yes. At least that.
And then they extended it to a mile and a half. And you put down two torpedoes. And you could leave, if the safety to the train permitted. First, you left the caboose, you went back three quarters of a mile with two torpedoes. Then proceeded on back one half mile from the rear end of the train. Placed two more torpedoes on the track. Then, if safety to the train permitted, you could return to the first torpedoes, and you remained there until you were recalled by your engine or relieved by another flagman.
This would be a good opportunity, because you didn't mention this in the interview. They no longer have cabooses on freight trains. What were the purposes of a caboose when they did use them?
Well, that was our home away from home. We had our bed.
A hangout place.
We had our beds on there.
Yeah.
We had all our work clothes for any kind of weather. It was a place for the crew to ride on the back end. The cupola had a seat on each side of it for it. If the swing man was up toward the head end, the conductor usually occupied one side of the caboose and the flagman the other. Mm-hmm. In those days, we had to watch real close for hot boxes, brake rigging down, or anything that might, if you saw any fire or smoke coming out of the long train, well, you were supposed to stop the train, and we had an air valve right in the cupola of the caboose that we could set the air just like they would on the engine. And we had to take an examination on air to know how much to set, and if it was something real drastic, we just opened the valve wide open and put the train to emergency and bring it to a stop.
Did you have any means while the train was moving of communicating with the engineer from the caboose?
Hand signals.
Just hand signals. What kinds of signals?
Well,
standard ones, I'm sure.
I guess about the only way I could say it is what was provided by the rule book.
Yeah. What would be an example?
Well, if you moved your arm in a circle, that was back up. If you wanted to go ahead, you raised your hand up and down. If you wanted him to stop, you moved your hand back and forth down low your lantern.
The engineer has to look around out to his rear. How do you get his attention to see a hand signal?
Usually busted the air hose and put the train to emergency to wake him up.
But if things were going normally, you couldn't signal him because he wouldn't be looking around to see the signal, would he?
They were required by the rules to look back ever so often on curves. And to see if, a lot of times we'd use a red fusee back on the sticking out of the window of the cupola of the caboose in case there was something wrong. And wherever they could look back, why the engineer was supposed to look back and periodically and make sure that everything was okay. And
what
so
kind,
was the embankment.
What kind of a signaling system would you have in the dark when they couldn't see your hands?
Red fusee or lanterns.
I see, just moving it in the...
Yeah, use the lantern the same, the same way as you would a hand signal.
Now you referred to the long rules of the railroad. What are the long rules?
The what?
Long rules.
What about?
Well, you said, in those days, the crew consisted of a conductor and three brakemen, the head brakeman and the swing brakeman. The engine crew was an engineer and a fireman. The long rules of the railroad, and also the state law, required a flagman to protect the rear of the train.
As along with the rules of the railroad in Oregon, at that time, a brakeman had to have worked at least 6 months before he could work as a flagman. And if the crew was set up and the three brakemen, that one brakeman didn't have enough to protect the train, I worked as a flagman, they had to drop down till they got the confinement one with that had the 6 months along with the rules. What I meant was, along with the railroad rule book.
Okay.
With the railroad rule book, there were state laws that required.
Okay, I just misunderstood you on the tape, I think. Or the transcription is dead. See, I send these tapes to a woman who listens to them and then puts what she hears onto a computer. Mm-hmm. And sometimes she doesn't hear the right thing.
Well, that's all right. I get to talking.
I know.
John and I were sitting there. I'd have to think something.
I know. That's fine. I'm glad you did. Now we're skipping over to page 17. I was frozen to the job on passenger service, so I worked as a passenger conductor for about 3 years, or 3.5 years, till the war was over anyway. Of course, when the war was over, that broke that freeze, but I couldn't hold anything but chain gang freight as a brakeman.
All right. You
explained what chain gang freight meant.
Well, that's what I meant earlier.
You were just on the board, huh?
The board.
Yeah.
And it was just like a chain.
Okay.
You were a link in the chain.
Up.
And
Sure.
As the chain moved, it moved, yes.
Yeah, good. Then was about rationing during World War II. I remember that too, but I was younger than you are, so you have better memory of it than I do. John said, you had a car and were allowed about how much gas? And you said,
5 gallons.
5 gallons of gas a month, I think, something like that. I had an A stamp and just parked my car most of the time. Remind me what an A stamp is.
That was a, see, they had A, B, and C gas stamps. And the A was the minimum amount that they would allow a regular person.
Did that depend on kind of what kind of a job you had?
Then you either went to a B stamp or a C stamp, if whatever, and each one of those stamps was good for 5 gallons. So if you had to drive, say I lived over here, I couldn't find a place, and I had to have extra gas, then they'd issue me either B stamps or C stamps.
Okay.
Yeah. But A stamps was the basic, and the rest of it was whatever the ration board issued you.
Right. Now, I've got a section I call pressure. Okay, many times, like on the Idahoan going into Pendleton, I handled as high as maybe between 400 and 500 through tickets, in addition to the tickets that I'd give back and the cancellations for people that got off, got on, and ran. Got on and ran. What did you mean there?
Well, I had to give them back so that when they got off Pendleton, they'd run to catch the other train. They would have, we'd come down the main line there at Pendleton. Well, then for the train that went to Wallula and Spokane, went up to Spokane, they had over on another track. And they had coaches that they would come in there and unload. And
just making your connection then.
Yeah.
Okay. And then we used to haul a lot of people down in the canyon. Which canyon?
Well, Meacham Creek Canyon. From Meacham. See, there wasn't any roads down there. And there was a section crew at Huron, a section crew at Duncan, and a section crew at North Fork.
Did you say a section crew at Huron?
Yeah.
Huron?
Huron. H-U-R-O-N.
Oh, Huron. Yes, I remember that.
And then later they had telegraphers at Huron, Duncan, and Gibbon, but the only way they could get in and out was on the passenger train.
Yeah. And then when the derailment occurred, when they changed that around, the Le Grand de Joseph run, I went to Portland on passenger in December of 60. And of course, I just got put back to work. I had a derailment in Meacham early in the spring of 60. Did you mean 61, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think you meant the spring of 61?
No, 60. That was the summer when I was anchored.
Well, I was a little mixed up on the sequence here. I went to Portland on
and
passenger.
And when I got put back to work in November of 60, I got fired in March. And then I went to work at the airport. And I worked at the airport all summer long.
Oh, I see.
And because I had been able to secure employment, George Baker wouldn't put me back to work.
I think I'll put in another had there. I had had a derailment in Meacham early in the spring of 60. That helps.
And
time sequence.
I think it was in March.
Page 22.
March of 60 when I had the derailment. Of course, there was between me and one of the train masters, we'd had a few words.
And
he had a chance to fire me.
Yeah. Page 25. This is when you were hauling freight on the Joseph branch. Then they'd get us in Dutch with the foreman of the sawmill in Wallawa, base lumber there, or Boise Cascade at Joseph. Is it Base, B-A-S-E?
B-A-T-E-S.
Bates.
Oh, yes.
J. Herbert Bates.
Okay. There the transcriptionist couldn't hear what you actually said. Bates. Okay. See, I'm trying to get this right.
Fine, I don't care.
Well, I do. page 30. This is when you were coming from Eli on the plane that you were just talking about earlier. United Airlines plane came in from Boise. We asked him what the weather was in Boise.
Well, that was in Eli.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you can make Boise all right, he said. It would take about 30 to 35 minutes.
All right.
So by the time we took off, the weather had begun to change. We got up this side of Wells. Where's that?
Oh, it's on Highway 93.
In Utah?
No, it's in Nevada.
Nevada.
It's on where 93 and Interstate 84 intersect.
Okay. Is it a small place?
Yeah, it's a little town down in there. There's a lot of Battle Mountain. Elko is one of the biggest of the bunch. But Wells was... See, there used to be a railroad track that run from believe it went out from Pocatello, Twin Falls, went out from Twin Falls down through Jackpot to Wells. There was a big copper mine at Ely and a smelter about 10-12 miles east, no, it'd be north of Ely. And they used to run this local train out there and haul ore back from this smelter. And it also intercepted the main line of the Union Pacific that went through Reno to San Francisco and Los Angeles. And it also... The track also made connection with the DNR at Elko.
Okay. Now, when you got up to the to Oregon, you thought you were in the Steens Mountain area. I knew where the Steens are, but about how far from La Grande?
Oh well, the Steens is south of Burns. It'd be about 30. Well, they go right down to the Nevada-Idaho line. On this side, they're sheer rock wall right up and down, and then they taper off down toward French Glen.
Right. I just wanted to know about how far away from here so that people could visualize you being in this plane and getting over the Steens when you were heading really to La Grande.
I would say that it would probably be... All from La Grande to the Steens would probably be about 150 miles.
Flight miles?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Because it's 60 miles west of Jordan Valley.
Okay. Here you are going flying into or out of Red's Ranch, the Minim River Strip. My passenger grabbed for everything he could find. Thank God he didn't grab the yoke.
The yoke is on a
steering wheel?
It's a control wheel.
Okay.
It's a wheel that controls the elevator and the aileron.
Okay. Good. That's all my questions. Do you want to tell us now about the internment trains that you witnessed?
Okay, the internment train was, when I first went to work on the railroad, they used to have these prisoner trains. And they'd move prisoners from one federal prison to another. These coaches had, I think either 3/8 or half inch bars over the windows. The windows could be opened from the inside because they weren't air conditioned to let air in. And there was a little room at each end for a guard to ride in with a machine gun or a shotgun or whatever arms they needed.
And these cars would come through Le Grand sometimes?
Oh, yeah. And whenever they had those, why, in those days with steam engines pulling those cars, if I remember right, they used to average somewhere between 10 and 12 cars. Well, going down, they used what they called a high wheel engine. Now, I can't explain that because I don't know. They were around an 80 to 81 inch drive wheel on the engine. They were faster out on the flat land, but they needed help over the mountain. But they most all of them only had a single air pump, and we had to give them the retaining valves that held 10 pounds of air against the brake cylinder. And the guards didn't want us to go through these cars with these prisoners. They didn't want to unlock the doors.
Yeah.
Well, when they moved all those Nisi or Japanese people out, they used these old coaches that had been used to transport prisoners to move them from Seattle and Portland and all along the coast area to Ontario and Nissa and Vail, and where they had the concentration camps over there.
I don't think they called them concentration camps then, but that's what they amounted to.
Well, that's more or less what they were accounted for.
Yes.
And they had guards on there riding. You would have thought they were the prisoner train. Yeah. These guards had these M1s that they were setting at these little booths at each end. Well, they didn't want us to go. We were supposed to have a special place for the train crew to ride. Well, our work at that time, we couldn't do it because we had to patrol the train. We had to give them air retaining valves so the engineer could handle the air going from Encina to Durkee and down the grade out of Baker, or coming off Camila to Hillgard. Why they had to use that retaining valve. Well, those guards that was on those trains, they didn't want us going through there. They didn't want us to even talk to those people. Why, hell, they weren't criminals or anything. And there were some of the just as nice of people as you ever talked to. In fact, I talked to some of them, and boy, the guards was right on me right now that I wasn't supposed to talk to them, that they... And I said, well, I don't have anything against them. They haven't done anything to me. Well, they bombed Pearl Harbor. Japs bombed Pearl Harbor, but these people didn't. Most of them was American citizens. And so, but they used, I had one of them. I was on work with one of them. I don't remember for sure just how many of those trains that they did run, but they run quite a few, several trains as they hauled them over there. And it was the funniest thing long years afterwards. This old section foreman that I worked for over at Tallahassee, George Kobayashi, I was working on, I went to Portland on passenger after I got put back to work in 60. And one night I was coming out of there on the Portland Road, and a little old guy walked up to me and he grabbed me by the arm and he said, Vern Druver, what are you doing on here? And I looked around and I didn't recognize him. He said, you don't recognize me, do you? He said, I'm George Kobayashi. He said, you worked for me at Tallahassee. And he said, he was just tickled to death to see me. And I said, well, where do you live, George? And he said, I wound up with a ranch between Payette and Weezer. And he said, I'm so much better off now that I'm not working for the railroad. But he said, he said they did a good thing by taking me over there. But I had a real nice visit with George.
Do you know how he spelled his last name?
I had a... No, because he didn't sign that name.
You think it might have been K-O-B...
It was K-O-B...
Y-A-S-H-I...
I-E or something like that, or just H-I, I'm not
sure.
Did
you pronounce it Kobayashi?
Yeah.
Probably A-S-H-I.
Probably S-H-I, yeah. I imagine.
When you tried to talk with some of the Japanese who were on the cars, the prisoners' cars, did you, any of them actually talk to you?
Oh, yeah.
What seemed to be their state of mind? Were they angry or confused? Or
some of them were, some of them weren't. Some of them were taking it pretty much in stride. I guess some of them had kind of been brainwashed down through what was going to happen. Mm. And some of the younger people, it was kind of hard for them to take, but a lot of the older ones, I think maybe they had been more or less brainwashed. And
did they have them handcuffed?
No, they didn't have enough. They just had two people to the seat, and they had every seat in the car full, and they had baggage and stuff to carry.
How do they eat?
They had a diner that they served box lunches.
Oh. And there was a toilet on the car?
Huh?
Was there a toilet on the
car?
Yeah.
They were required. That was state law then there. But there was a man's toilet and a woman's toilet. Of course, they weren't the most sanitary. Most of them, they just set over an open hole, and when they used it, it dumped it right out on the track.
Yeah, I wondered about that. In your days walking the tracks as a flagman, did you smell it pretty well?
Yeah. Most of it was hit right along the end of the ties. We usually walked right down the middle of the track. There was very little stuff dropped in between the rails. It mostly hit along at the end of the ties.
That was good for you then.
Oh, yeah.
Except
but
for the smell.
You'd be surprised. Now, how fast that material would deteriorate,
yeah.
Especially on a hot day or the wind is blowing like today. It'd be dry and nothing,
yeah.
No time at all.
Because yeah.
Usually it was dumped with water, mm-hmm. and the train was probably be doing up as high as 80, 90 miles an hour.
Right. John, do you have any more questions?
No.
Sure.
You covered quite well.
There's one, of course, it's a very gruesome thing that happened. When I was working out of Portland, one morning going in on the city of Portland, that was when they were starting to build the John Day Dam down there east of the Dalles. The wind was blowing like everything. And I was the head brakeman. Conductor and I were setting up in the up in the dome coach, because most of the passengers were back to the diner for breakfast. It's double track from Biggs Junction to west of the Dalles. And we had gone on to double track and going through where the old Salila Falls used to be. We went to emergency. Train went to emergency. Conductor said to me, he said, "My God, where in there went a bedroll?" And I said, where in the world did a bedroll come from?
You mean on the track?
Huh?
On the track?
Yeah, I'll tell you how it happened.
Okay.
I had just clocked the train with a stopwatch. We were doing 96 miles an hour. When the train goes to emergency at that speed, it takes between 3.5 to 4 miles to stop. By the time we stopped, we backed up. And I asked the engineer, I said, what did you hit? He said, there were two men walking down the track, right down the middle of the track. He said, I blew the whistle, I rang the bell. Evidently, the wind was blowing, they didn't hear me. One guy with his bedroll went off to the right of the engine and wound up where the highway makes. Goes over out into the Columbia River down there, right below it's a lot of that bridge that goes over the wage ramp. There's a big lake in there. So one of the bodies went right in that lake. And his bedroll is floating along on top of the water. We backed up, and I rode the back end of the train back. And the biggest piece. One of them was from his chin to his thighs. The rest, and it was, that part would get busted open like a ripe watermelon. It had cut his feet off, get about that high above his shoes. He had shoes something like this. And his feet were laying heel to heel on a tie. On one tie, and his shoes was laying two ties further up, heel to heel. And we tried to keep it covered up until the state police got out there. Well, the state police said, come over here to the highway. He said, I want a statement. And this conductor said, the accident is over here on the track. If you want a statement, you come over here. Well, these two state police that walked over there, one of them turned around and went back to the car. He was so sick he couldn't even look. And we were trying to keep the seagulls and crows and stuff from picking up the pieces. One of these guys' caps was just split from the back edge of it right to it was a baseball cap, to the button on the top. And drove under a splinter on a tie on the opposite track, and it was drove in there so tight you couldn't pull it out. And they got the undertaker out from the dowels to clean it up, and they gathered it all up as much as they could. And to this day, I don't know why they didn't feel the ground shake in there with the train, or unless the wind was blowing so hard that they just assumed it was wind. But they never looked back or anything. The engineer said they just walked along down the track. And when from the time he saw him and he went to emergency, why, going 4 miles, why, it takes
a flat wheel.
Huh?
He had the flat wheel.
Well, they had those automatic brakes that when they'd start to slide, they'd release a little. That's one reason it took so long to stop.
Most of the time, you know, they used to have a flat wheel.
Oh, yeah.
You'd slip along there.
Slide them and get flat wheels out.
That's the worst thing for an engineer to know that he's going to hit somebody and he can't do anything about it. Like he couldn't stop for 3.5 miles.
No, this was a passenger train, you said?
Yeah, the city of Portland, Greenliner.
I imagine people were hoping they could get out and look.
A lot of people didn't know anything that happened. Most of them were back in the diner. The conductor and I were the only ones in the cupola that saw the bedroll fly.
I imagine the passengers asked you what happened.
Oh, yeah.
What did you tell them?
Oh, we just had a little accident.
A little accident.
No, I'll tell you, anything that made you really sick was hit a car, hit somebody on the track. One time in Pendleton, we was coming in there on a train. I was working the head end. That was after we got diesel. And there was a door in the front end of the diesel that you could open and go from one unit to the next. We came by St. Anthony Hospital and we saw a little child on the track down below. That's when the old highway come down there by the woolen mill. When I saw that little child, I jumped down the seat and I run down and opened this door. And I leaned out over the drawbar in hopes that maybe I could grab it, the little child, so we wouldn't hit it. The fireman, he'd come down as tall as I am. I could reach further than he. And I was laying clear out over the end of the drawbar and he was sitting on my feet so I wouldn't fall on out. This little child's mother come down the bank. She had high-heeled shoes on. How in the world she run through that gravel and track? She went across in front of that engine, grabbed that child, and out on the other side. The engine never touched her. I could almost touch her, but we'd already gone to emergency. We hadn't got stopped. We had slowed down because Pendleton had 10-mile-an-hour speed limits.
Can't blow your whistle.
No, you can't blow the whistle in Pendleton. And how in the world if she'd ever tripped or turned an ankle or anything, we would have hit her and that child.
What's your opinion about the requirement that in some cities, most cities, you blow the whistle when you're going through a crossing?
I think that is something that should never be stopped, because it doesn't make any difference. People, they holler about that whistle. I saw time and time again there in Pendleton where it was against the city rule, and come down there on the main line there for the old depot where the Broadway, or what is that, Broadway or that main street? It runs north and south. Main Street, I guess. Anyway, we hit more cars on Main Street because they'd see that train coming. Well, I can make it. And they'd pour it on, and just as the train hit the crossing, and kawham. And there used to be some storage tracks over there just to the west of Main Street. And I don't know how many times I've seen cars plastered up against those box cars in the storage track the trains had hit.
You seem to be saying, though, that they were trying to beat the train. How would a whistle slow them down?
It could have warned them that we were closer to the crossing than what they actually thought we were.
I see.
Because the engineer was required to blow two longs, a short and a long. And the last long whistle was to be drugged into the crossing. So that if he was coming down there, and out here up towards St. Anthony Hospital, coming down that hill, 10 miles an hour, a long, a short, and a long just before the engine hit the crossing, the cars would know that he was just about to go across onto the crossing.
Would they try to go through the gates?
Well, they didn't have gates.
Oh, no gates.
Down there were the Hawthorne schools, that too.
Yeah.
Because you went over that hump.
Yeah.
Around that little curve.
Yeah.
That way.
Well, do you think that having gates now makes a difference in whether their whistles are helpful?
Yes, I do, because there's some idiot that's always going to try to go around the end of the gate.
There are.
I don't quite see how the whistle would stop a person who had that kind of an urge.
At least it would.
I'm sure it does.
Oh, I'll get that. I think that pouch with my name tag is up there. I'll get it.
John,
is that still running?
Yeah, it is. I wanted to ask you, What was the most unpleasant part of working for the railroad as you did?
All hours, day and night. You never
Your did. Sleep was always interrupted?
Interrupted. You had to sleep days, you had to sleep when you had a chance.
Never had a holiday with your family?
Never. I don't know how many years I worked that I was never there for Thanksgiving or Christmas. And you never had any, you never could lay off around the holidays. And if anything you had to plan, wanted to do, well, you had to plan it when it was some other time than something special.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I told the wife when I retired, I said, I can go to bed and I don't have to sleep with one ear open through the telephone. And it seemed like the majority of the calls at night was anywhere from about 12:30 in the morning up to about 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning.
It was better when you were on the turn for the passenger.
Very much.
Because you knew what your schedule was when you were running.
I knew what time when I was going to work. I could mark a calendar a year ahead and know what days I'd be home. And see, I made a trip every 4 days. Well, when I got in off the run, I was gone. Like I was due out tonight on the Portland Road out of Portland at 8:45. This is Wednesday. Thursday, I'd spend in Huntington. Friday morning, I was due back in Portland at 9:10. The wife could have the camper ready, or I could get it ready the day before, or if we wanted to go somewhere, jump in the car and take off. I had all that day, all that night, all the next day, and the next night at home, and then I had to sleep the following day to go to work. And that was 11 years was about the nicest job I had. The best paying job I had was out on Joseph Ranch. That was a mortgage lifter. But this job out of Portland was you had some time to do something, and you knew whether you were going to be home on a holiday or if to plan your holiday meals so the day that you were home.